The second case for oral argument this morning is in the matter of Otter Tail Power Company. For the appellants, Isaac Walton Lee et al., we have Jeanette Brimmer, correct? An attorney from St. Paul, welcome. And Professor John Davidson from the law school in Vermilion. And for the Appley Otter Tail et al., we have Thomas Welk, attorney from Sioux Falls, and Mr. John Smith, an assistant attorney general representing the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission. Mr. Welk, I understand you will be presenting for 10 minutes first, and then Mr. Smith second for 10 minutes?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you. With that, Ms. Brimmer, you may proceed. You have 20 minutes.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Jeanette Brimmer. I'm with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, and along with my co-counsel, Mr. Davidson, I represent the joint interveners in this case. And as has been noted, that includes the Isaac Walton League of America, their Midwest regional office. It includes the Union of Concerned Scientists, which is a national organization, and it includes Fresh Energy, which is a Minnesota-based nonprofit. The joint interveners come before this court asking for reversal of the decision of the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission permitting decision for the Big Stone Unit 2 coal-fired power facility. We ask for that reversal because Big Stone 2 is a threat of serious injury to the environment based upon the record and on South Dakota statutes, in that it will increase carbon dioxide emissions from South Dakota as much as 34% at a time when it is agreed that large reductions of carbon dioxide emissions are necessary to avoid the most catastrophic consequences of climate change and global warming. And so it is the position of the joint interveners that the permit should be denied under the plain language of the statute. Briefly, the standard of review that applies in this case is that of de novo review. That's the standard we'd like to concentrate on with the court today. That is because this really represents a legal conclusion in applying a statute to uncontested facts in this case. We believe that it is up to this court to decide what the key language of our citing statute means. That language is what constitutes a threat of serious injury to the environment under South Dakota law. That's an application of the law in this case, and it is up to this court to decide the level of evidence necessary to meet that test. Moving on to the argument, I'd like to just briefly preview the argument for the court. We will first address the statute itself. We will outline the statutory terms for the court. We will then discuss how global warming is indeed a serious injury to the environment, as that concept is contemplated by the statute. And we'll review the record in this case of uncontested evidence on that point.
Let me go back to the standard review. Isn't the question of whether or not a facility constitutes a threat to the environment, a serious threat, environmental threat, isn't that a factually based question? I mean, that would implicate the clearly erroneous standard review.
Justice Zintner, I believe that it is certainly a decision that has to look at the facts in the record. It has to be based upon the facts in the record. In this case, though, you have a record where the facts are largely uncontested. Dr. Hausman, whose testimony we will talk about.
Well, just a minute. Let me interrupt you because I got to interrupt you because the two experts, quote unquote, certainly did not agree. So we have a conflict.
Justice, I think that's a good observation. The experts did not agree on the legal conclusion to be drawn from the facts. For example, you've got Dr. Hausman, who talks a lot about the threat of serious injury. He talks a lot about the evidence for global warming. He is certainly eminently qualified. He's an atmospheric scientist. He also has degrees in water resource engineering. Certainly, he's got the necessary background to give expert opinion on that matter. The competing evidence that is cited to by the appellees is that primarily of Mr. Uggeroot, who is an interested party. He works for Otter Tail Power Company. And Mr. Uggeroot largely did an arithmetic calculation, in this case, which is also uncontested. We do not contest the arithmetic calculation. But he is really, by his own resume, not an atmospheric scientist. He is not a scientist with respect to global warming emissions or carbon dioxide and what would constitute a large versus small amount or a threat. Instead, he gave an opinion on whether the arithmetic calculation met what is really a legal or statutory standard here. Of a power plant cannot pose a threat of serious injury. And we would pose that in applying a record that is largely uncontested, really when you look at those pieces, to the statutory language here, we really are in the realm of the court, and that the court gets to make those decisions and determine on a de novo review how to make legal conclusions from the facts. We would submit that the disagreement here really was about that ultimate conclusion of what the facts mean under the statutory language.
I suppose that power has to be generated in some manner in some location. Does the location of this proposal have any relevance to your concerns?
Justice Goodwin, I think some of the national, groups would say no, the location does not. I mean, obviously, there is a concern for global warming across the board. And I think that the legislature astutely recognized in passing this statute that there could be broad-based environmental harm. They didn't necessarily confine it to a certain type of pollutant or a certain type of harm. Certainly some of the joint interveners are concerned because this is very close to the state of Minnesota, and so they have a more regional or state-based concern, and that is driving a lot of their concern.
I was just trying to conclude, say that the proposal was to put it 5 miles out of pier. Are you still here with the same concerns?
Justice Jefferson, that's a good question. I don't know which groups. I would submit that probably the Union of Concerned Scientists and the Isaac Walton League would, yes, still be concerned. It probably gets to a judgment call on your bylaws and your resources for some of the other groups at that point.
All right. Thank you.
Have the facts changed here? Because since the PUC decision, I seem to have read that there's some of the partners have pulled out, and the Big Stone is... Big Stone 2 is going to be a smaller project. Does that change the facts since the PUC made its decision?
Justice Konenkamp, I don't think, it certainly doesn't change the facts that we've got at our disposal here. It is true that some of the parties have pulled out. I know that that has caused there to be some revisiting of what the project is going to look like, particularly in the Minnesota proceedings. In terms of the record that we have before us here, though, we are unsure what it is going to look like.
Does it make our case a little bit hypothetical, though? I mean, we're basing the facts we're looking at are no longer the facts. It's going to be a smaller project. Does that, in a sense, make us an advisory body on a case?
Your Honor, I don't think that the court should be overly concerned with being advisory in this case. I think that everything that we do know, obviously outside the record, makes it difficult to talk about it within certain parameters, but there will be a project, that it will still be a coal-fired power plant. My understanding is that it will likely still be very sizable. Perhaps not the in excess of 600 megawatts, but if you can indulge me outside the record to this degree, I think we are hearing something in the neighborhood of 500 or a little over 500 megawatts, still a fairly sizable operation.
CO2, though, I mean, the numbers you're talking about in terms of this, the pollutants would be lower.
Presumably, we don't know what those are, though.
Thank you.
Thank you. Turning to the language of the statute that is under consideration here today, South Dakota Statutes 49-41B-22, and in particular subpart 2 that we are here on, indicates that the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission is not to permit a power plant that will pose a threat of serious injury to the environment. And that is the language that we are here on today. We believe that that test should have resulted in a denial of the permit in this case and on this record.
What relief are you seeking from this court, then?
We are seeking reversal of the decision to grant the permit, and remand for further proceedings before the PUC. Let me be clear, I don't think that means that this plant can't get built under any circumstances. I think there are other options, but under the circumstances before you and the permit that was granted, we believe that was improper under the statute.
So, if I'm understanding, what you're asking us to do is determine that as a matter of law that the levels of CO2 emissions are a threat.
That's correct, Justice Meyer-Henry. We believe that on this record, the levels of CO2 constitute a threat and that the serious injury is the global warming injury that was discussed in the record. Yes.
Well, if that's the case, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't recall anything in your brief where you took issue with the trial court's ruling where Judge Wilbur said that everyone in the room agreed that science was still out on the ultimate questions involved here.
Justice, with all due respect to the circuit court, I don't think that that is true, and we did disagree vociferously during the arguments and at the time, and I think our brief does argue that this is clearly a threat of serious injury and that that's what the evidence of the case sets forth. I think that basically Dr. Hausman testified that it is unequivocal and that it is agreed, citing to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, some of the best minds in the world that we can turn to on this kind of question, that in fact global warming is happening. It is happening in many respects at a rate that we had not anticipated, and that it is human-caused, that human events are, in fact, accelerating climate change and are causing the problem.
Well, if the science is settled and this is a question of law, then what additional amount of CO2 emission would not pose a serious threat? In other words, what size facility would meet the standard in this case? If the science is settled, then we should be able to quantify that. And where do you draw? What does the record suggest? Where should we draw this line?
Well, I think what the record suggests is we should at least draw the line to include this case. Well,
that's not what I'm asking.
I understand, Your Honor. And I think that what's difficult to answer about that is we are then dealing with a hypothetical. So how far would we go down the scale of CO2 emissions where we would still argue that a permit should be denied? First of all, that's one of the reasons we turn to experts like Dr. Hausman. I would say I'm not qualified to make that judgment. That's why we rely on that. That's why the South Dakota PUC invites that kind of evidence, so that we can have experts like Dr. Hausman testify in that regard. I think also in this case that was put forth in the brief and in the record, that you don't have to make that decision in this case and maybe even in other cases, because we do have alternatives. We have offsetting alternatives that were discussed during the course of this case where you could build a plant. That plant could even emit CO2. But there are methods for dealing with it, just like we have dealt with other pollutants, where you could not be an increase in those emissions in terms of the total, and that would provide a viable alternative. So in many respects, Your Honor, we don't have to get to that question of how far down the scale we might have to go by applying other solutions that we have and that were discussed in the record. Otherwise, as I said, I think I would have to rely on the experts. And at least in this case, on this evidence, the experts are saying that this does pose a threat.
Now, my understanding then, too, is that there is no regulation, state, federal, any kind of agency, that's ever set the standard.
That's correct, Justice Meyer-Henry. There is no current, and that was argued in the South Dakota PUC's brief. And they said that we believe it would be outside of our authority or uncomfortable with doing what the joint interveners have requested in this case, because there's nothing for us to go on in terms of other states regulating carbon dioxide emissions. We have two really responses to that. First, that's changed. The landscape has indeed changed. Since that time, The U.S. Supreme Court has spoken on this issue, the Massachusetts versus Environmental Protection Agency case that came down just this year. Cites were provided in all the parties' briefs to that case, in which the U.S. Supreme Court was called upon to judge EPA's decision not to regulate carbon dioxide. And one of the arguments was it's not really a pollutant under the Clean Air Act. And in fact, the U.S. Supreme Court has said, we believe it is a pollutant. We believe that the rulemaking petition before the EPA to regulate is proper and that the EPA needs to act on that. They did not dictate the action. But clearly there is a movement to regulation in that regard from the U.S. Supreme Court themselves. Most recently, I think that we supplied for an informational piece for the court, the decision in Kansas by the Kansas Secretary of the Environment that carbon dioxide does represent a pollutant under their statutes, that he is concerned represents a threat to the environment and a threat to public health. So there is movement in that direction. Moreover, it's not really within the clear language of the statute to pick and choose among pollutants. The clear language of the statute was really more prescient than that. The legislature really was clearly thinking about protecting the citizens of South Dakota and the region from something before it happened, protecting against threats of serious injury to the environment without dictating that it has to be a regulated pollutant, clearly recognizing that oftentimes regulation takes a while to catch up with knowledge, takes a while to catch up with the science, and I think that that's exactly the case that we have here. And so the statute is broader than regulated pollutants. As indicated, I'd like to spend a little bit of time, just the record is obviously voluminous in this case, and I think it would be helpful to talk a little bit about how the record in this case does fit the language of the statute and dictate the result that joint interveners would like to see in this case. Again, Dr. Hausman presented the testimony. He was not cross-examined. There was a choice to not cross-examine him, so his testimony came in uncontested in that regard. He testified, I'd like to concentrate particularly on the region. We all know that carbon dioxide is a global pollutant. There's a lot of talk about China and India and things like that. But it was important to the joint interveners to make clear that we're going to feel these impacts right in our backyard as well. And Dr. Hausman did address that. He talked about the fact that we will see increased heat, many more days that are hot, many hotter days, that in turn will result in things like decreased soil moisture. It will result in droughts increasing in both severity and frequency. That in turn is going to have an impact on Minnesota and South Dakota's agricultural economy. We already know that we have water issues in this region of the United States, and those are going to be exacerbated likely at great cost to both of our economies. There's going to be, according to Dr. Hausman, increases in public health impacts. We will see increase in heat-related mortality, for example, as the impacts of global warming really hit home even more than they have so far.
But what, you know, I guess, even if we totally agree with your analysis, isn't that a policy? Isn't this really a policy, the decision that needs to be made, either the executive branch or the legislative branch, on how you balance all of these things, and whether it's just this power plant that can't be built, or are there other things that have to be done to balance it out, and what do, what should the regulations be? What should be prohibited, and what should be allowed? And those seem to me to be widespread policy decisions that probably should not be made one power plant at a time.
Justice Meyer-Henry, I think that your observation that this could be addressed from a policy perspective is astute. But I think that what we have before us is that the legislature has given direction on this. They have said, don't give a permit to a power plant that is a threat of serious injury to the environment. That is a policy decision, and that decision has been made. And they have made those dictates clear. Now, is it possible that they could say, well, this is a new pollutant and we need to deal with that differently? The legislature can, but they have not. They have instead relied upon the directive that they have already given, which is broad-based and fairly protective. And we also, interestingly, have the Massachusetts case where the U.S. Supreme Court grappled somewhat with that very concept, where the Environmental Protection Agency said, we really need to leave this to the policymakers. And yet the U.S. Supreme Court said, sure, the policymakers have a role, but we also have a statute. And we have the Clean Air Act, and Congress has dictated regulation under that. And we believe, pending further policy decisions that may come down, that regulation of carbon dioxide right now is appropriate under the statutory language. I think you have a similar situation here. You have statutory language that applies. There may very well be further policy decisions in the future, but the policy that you have right now is to prevent threats of serious injury to the environment. I see that my time is up. If there are no further questions.
Was there any evidence or any support for the argument that in this time and place, under these circumstances, anything more than, say, 300 megawatts would have been out of the question, that it would be a threat of serious injury? Anything like that, have they ever drawn the line, or was there any support for any evidence or testimony that anything over 300 megawatts would be too severe? Anything over 400 megawatts would be too severe? Anything along that line?
Justice Abrams, no. There was no evidence or discussion in the record in terms of something less than the current proposal and what that would mean. All of the parties that were testifying were doing so on the specifics of what Big Stone 2 had indicated and agreed that it would emit in terms of carbon dioxide, the 4.7 million tons.
So we come down to where one side is saying 600 is okay, and the other side is saying 600 is too much, right?
If I may recharacterize, I think the joint interveners are clearly saying the 4.7 million tons of carbon dioxide attributable to that size megawatt is too much, clearly, yes. I would characterize Mr. Uggerman's testimony as not so much that it's not too much, but that it just doesn't seem like a lot. The appearance of that is not a lot relative to global sources. But I would add that Mr. Uggerman did not expound on that in terms of, neither did he say why he thought that that wasn't so much, nor why he thought that that would not amount to injury.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Welk, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Members of the court, good morning. My name is Tom Welk. I represent the owners of the proposed Big Stone 2 power plant. I will try to confine my remarks to the record below and some of the issues that were evolving around the pellets issue about the environmental concerns. And Mr. Smith will be talking primarily about the policy issues on behalf of the commission. Very quickly, Your Honor, it's evident from reading the briefs, this is a 600-megawatt coal-fired power plant that's going to be constructed adjacent to the existing Big Stone 1 facility. This is a baseload electric generation plant, which means simply it has to be available 24/7, 365 days a week. We haven't had a plant built in the Midwest since the 80s. It's indisputable that the findings made by the commission that the owners of the power plant have a severe need, and the customers, which are primarily rural customers, which are over in the hundreds of thousands, need this base electricity in the future. And there's been suggestions in the record, which I'll talk about later, about alternatives, but those were all carefully looked at by the commission, and those are not sufficient to meet the undisputed need that the owners and their customers need. This plant will take approximately 4 years to build. It's over $1 billion. It takes a long lead time to construct these plants. There has been a significant number of environmental studies by the companies, the consultants, the federal government. There's a federal EIS project that's in place. This project demonstrates through the record the vastness of the environmental studies that have been conducted. The record that you have before you today, Your Honors, is over 8,000 pages. The commission entered over 200 findings of fact. We answered over 500 discovery requests. We made available over 47,000 documents. There were over 20 witnesses that testified in a multi-proceeding. There were multiple public input hearings. There were over 2,000 pages of testimony. There were input from local governmental authorities. And there are no issues that I think that are significant other than the CO2 issue. And you think about this gargantuan record, this huge project, and we're here on a single issue.
Were there alternatives that your company had to reduce? Are there different methods that they can use, or different procedures or technologies that they can use to reduce it? Was that presented?
Yes. If you will go to findings of fact 161 to 180, the Commission considered alternate energy sources from wind, biomass, hydropower, solar, geothermal, combined cycle natural gas, and integrated coal gasification. All those were explored. And evidence was presented on those alternatives and what existed to meet the need. Those were clearly in the case below, Your Honor.
Is there technology state-of-the-art as far as reducing emissions for carbon dioxide?
Well, what the technology had, this all involves what I was going to get to, Your Honor, about the air quality issues. And the air quality issues are not confined to CO2. As you pointed out, Justice Meyer-Henry, there are no regulations on CO2, but we do have regulated pollutants, sulfur dioxide, nitrous oxide, that are emitted from the plant that are regulated. And what this plant does is puts technology in place to reduce the SO2 emissions to 1/7 of what's coming out of Big Stone 1. That's what was important to the Commission. So SO2, a named pollutant that is regulated, will be 1/7 from two plants versus one. The nitrous oxide will be equal from two plants to one. In other words, you'll have two plants and it will be approximately the same level of nitrous oxide. Mercury, which is unquestionably from the studies that presented a matter that had to be addressed, the project has committed 3 years after commercial operation to have the same level of emissions of mercury than it will for two plants than it does for one. So the appellants have narrowed this issue to CO2, an unregulated pollutant, and the Commission wasn't confined to that role. It had a much broader role, and it wasn't looking at CO2 only. It was looking at all of these things. And so the company is putting a multi-million dollar wet scrubber that's going to help with all of these. We have a supercritical boiler that's going to reduce the pollutants. There are just millions and millions of dollars are being spent to reduce the pollutants. And what the appellants have done is, have they not talked about that? But there is an entire section dealing with air quality issues, findings of fact 119 through 139. And the Commission, point by point, went down SO2, NOx, the pollutants that are there, and addressed all of those, and then turned to carbon dioxide. And this is not a situation where an agency just said, I'm going to ignore the issue. It didn't. And Mr. Smith will talk about that. The Commission led into evidence proposed legislation that never even got through Congress, regulatory frameworks from other states and the federal government that have never been adopted, things regarding computing external costs and environmental costs. The Commission let all of that in. It's clearly speculative as to what somebody's going to do, but they heard all that. This isn't something that a couple of people got up and talked about. It was a major proceeding that was addressed by the Commission. And when you look at these 200 findings and look at what the Commission did, they carefully considered these issues. And they're dealing with a framework, an unregulated pollutant. All right, and they're trying to, and they're supposed to be the super agency when everybody in the world can't figure out the standard. But they didn't just blow it off and just say, we're not going to care about it. They put a condition in the permit that requires the companies to report on regulatory changes, on what you're doing, and if there's new technology out there, what are you doing? And that's why when the Commission announced its decision, what they took a global view for, Your Honors, is we like the positive environmental effects of this plant. And you can't consider it in a vacuum on one issue. And so if you look at what Commissioner, now Chairperson Dusty Johnson said, we like the economic benefits, but we like the environmental things that the companies are doing to reduce the emissions. So if this plant is not built, then you're not going to have available the things that they are going to do to reduce the emissions. And simply, to Justice Zinner's point, This, in my view, is the quintessential fact question. If this isn't the quintessential fact question, I don't know what it is. Now, the appellants have posited the issue of CO2, does this facility provide a serious threat to the environment? That's not the issue that was in front of the PUC. The PUC has a much broader scope, and they took their job very seriously. And they went through item by item and adopted these findings and carefully, and they didn't adopt all the findings we suggested. We didn't suggest a number of the conditions that they wanted, but they took it upon themselves to regulate what's going to happen. And I do want to address Justice Konenkamp's issue because I think it's a fair point. I know it's outside the record, but brought up about the people that are withdrawing. Your Honor, it isn't going to be an advisory opinion. There will be a change in the project, and there will be either two scopes that will happen. Either we'll reduce the plant to 500, which doesn't take away the carbon dioxide issue, and I agree with the appellate's counsel, or the other alternative is to bring in another partner. So those are essentially the two alternatives that the project has. But
you're not thinking we should remand this so that we can look at the new facts?
Absolutely not, Justice Konenkamp, because we will have to report to the commission whatever the project decides. That's an obligation that we have to the commission. So we'll go back, and we'll be reporting, and they can open it up if they want, and I'm sure people will come and look at it. We have an obligation to report any material changes. But we, as the project, should have the benefit of all of the time and effort that we've put in here on a law of the case doctrine. This is the only issue in this plant from the state siting permit that exists. And so if we have an issue as arising because of a withdrawal, the commission is apt to have a hearing, to do whatever they want to deal with that, and they have the authority to do that. So that's why, Justice Konenkamp, this is not an advisory opinion. You have a record. It's fully there. And I do agree with the appellate's counsel that you need to address the issue head on. In regard to the CO2 issues themselves, Smith will obviously address those. But you essentially had Dr. Hausman, who submitted written testimony, and there was no cross-examination. And there were particular findings made on the CO2 and global warming and what those issues are. And the PUC is not the super agency to determine global warming. One of the things the court should take solace in the fact is this siting permit, which is basically to site the facility, is conditioned upon obtaining other permits. We have to get water permits, which we've done, by the way, two sources. We went out and followed one of the recommendations. We have to get an air permit. We have solid waste permits. These are conditions to the siting permit. We have to go out there, and the PUC is not the super permitting agency. They rely on agencies with expertise to look at those particular issues. But they did look at this issue, and they
did. Time has expired, counsel.
All right, thank you, man.
Mr. Smith, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honors. My name is John Smith, Assistant Attorney General representing the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission. I honestly am a little less at a loss as to what's left here to talk about, but I'll have a go at it. I think it's really, if you look at really the argument of the appellants and the other briefs that have been submitted, I think we could all probably fairly easily conclude that the real simplistic finding and conclusion, if you want to call it that, made by the commission, that this particular facility will not cause global warming. I don't think Ms. Bremer or anyone else out there would submit that this particular facility will cause global warming. If this were the only power plant on Earth, we wouldn't have to worry about global warming. The fact is, as appellant's own witness clearly pointed out in his testimony, and if you like, I've got it here and I can cite to the pages. The sources that are alleged to be causing global warming via CO2 emissions, and that's strictly man-made emissions, he stated the magnitude sources such as the Big Stone power plant, we're talking hundreds of thousands of those globally. Other manufactured type, what are called non-point sources, smaller sources, cars, trucks, all of that, we're talking potentially in the billions. And that's even a drop in the bucket, in a sense, concerning man-made emissions to CO2. We're now talking about a world population that is, what, approaching 6 billion people. Every one of us is a CO2 emitter. Because CO2, unlike the other polluting gases we've talked about, SOx, NOx, all of that, mercury, CO2 is an essential part of our environment. We literally can't live without it. It always has been a critical component of the atmosphere. Plants rely on it to perform photosynthesis. They in turn metabolize or reduce that CO2 into oxygen, and they take the carbon out of there and they use that carbon to produce the sugars, carbohydrates, that every living thing on the planet relies on for life. And that's a fact, and that's one of the critical things that differentiates CO2 and the CO2 problem from other kinds of problems. Because this is an ubiquitous element in the world. And I would venture to say, really, other than, I think it is the most challenging, it's certainly by far and away, and assuming the scientists, some of them are right about global warming, this is by far and away the most difficult environmental challenge that will ever have been attempted to be faced. It just is. It will not be solved by the South Dakota PUC refusing to permit a power plant that the evidence showed the citizens of our state of Minnesota, state of North Dakota, need. We need it in a fairly near term to meet what are called the NERC reliability standards. And what that does is it keeps the lights on, particularly on days, and particularly the high peak days like the summer, the winter, when we get up against those points where you lose a power plant and the whole system goes down. Given if you agree that with respect to Big Stone alone, the Big Stone power plant alone not posing a serious environmental threat, and we move on to what the real issue is. The real issue is, should the commission have denied this permit because there are millions of CO2 sources out there that contribute CO2, and we should therefore step in on an ad hoc basis in this particular case, no standards to rely on. We have no standards to look to. Nothing. There's nothing that says on a megawatt hour basis, if you emit X amount of CO2 per megawatt hour, then it's okay. We have nothing to rely on. We would have to make it up. We would have to make it up in an adjudicatory setting involving one particular facility. And if we were to deny this, and Mr. Rolfes of Otter Tail, who's sitting in the back there, if he were then to say, well, then how are we going to meet the needs that we have to? We have to, as a matter of federal law, come up with some additional generation. How are we going to do that? My assumption, he's going to do what every other power plant owner out there is going to do. They're going to come in with a natural gas plant. So they come in with a permit for a natural gas plant. Does natural gas produce less CO2 per megawatt hour than coal? Yes, it does. It indeed does. But I guess the question I have to you is, it will still do what appellants criticize us for. It will still produce a measurable quantity of CO2 on a global scale. So what are we going to do? Just arbitrarily say, well, because it produces less, then it's okay. I think the question we're faced with is an utter absence of standards. How much less is less? And is an adjudication involving one particular facility in a standardless environment the right way to address global warming?
Well, less is still better. You'd have to concede that. It's not worse.
It's not worse, I guess. And I guess an analogy I would draw, Your Honor, and maybe I'm outside of thinking on this, but my understanding of South Dakota law, and in the many, many cases I've been involved in involving administrative law in this state over the years, our philosophy is that constitutionality, if you want to call it that, due process, requires that there be standards to guide decision-making. I guess a real simplistic analogy I'd draw is you get in your car when you leave here today after the argument's over and you take off and the police officer stops you and he says, well, and you say, what do I stop you for? And you say, well, you're going too fast. And he says, and you say, well, I am. Well, how fast is too fast? And he says, well, you're going faster than that other guy. Well, then how much slower do you have to go to be going slow enough? And if the other guy's going slower than that, is that slow enough? I think that's my point, is fairness to a company like Otter Tail, to all of these companies, demands, for one thing, when you have standards, you know what to do. We know what to design for. And I might point out that this particular coal plant, you know, we conjure up these boogeyman images in our mind of this thing belching out black smoke. Not. It's not the way this plant will be. In fact, it will be built at the highest efficiency level achievable today for a coal plant. It's called supercritical pulverized coal technology. That's the best there is if you're going to use coal. So the alternative is for us to just, the commission, to just ad hoc, in an adjudication, say, we're banning coal because you could build natural gas or you could do something else and maybe produce less CO2. No policy at the federal level. Yes, the Supreme Court has now told EPA, you can't avoid your responsibility to take a look at this issue. And after you take a look at it, you may determine that you should enact rules, standards. But as of this point in time, there are no standards. There is no CO2 standard. There is no regulatory program in place. My own, and if I, you know, based on my, on the evidence in this case, what we saw in terms of Congress wrestling with this, EPA's now wrestled with it for 15 years. This is a problem that needs to be dealt with a breadth of approach that we cannot get to. And personally, I don't believe the legislature in its wildest imagination assumed that it was delegating that kind of authority to this commission. I guess I should be advocating and say, well, by all means, I hope we have that kind of authority because this is going to be a mighty fun job. But I don't think that is the level of sort of massive policy-making authority to try to solve a global problem that the legislature probably intended when it passed the Siting Act. The last legislative expression on this subject was a resolution that I cite in my brief. I'm not going to dig through my pile here. That's the last words we've had from the legislature. They supported President Bush's Clear Skies Initiative, but in there, they extremely explicitly stated, provided it does not contain any CO2-related regulations. That's the last thing we've heard from the people that delegate our power to us. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Ms. Bremer, you have 10 minutes.
I would like to begin with some of the points made by Mr. Smith. He notes that this facility will not cause global warming, therefore it was properly permitted. Let's be clear, that's not the statutory requirement. Causation is not within the language of the statute. Rather, will it pose a threat, a potentiality of serious injury to the environment, not that it will cause on its own. Also, under the rules that are applicable here that we did brief, there is an obligation to consider this plant in conjunction with others, a so-called cumulative impacts test. Also, we would submit that then nothing in the world would cause, I mean, nothing in the world does cause global warming in and of itself. If that's the standard, we may very well be doomed because it will be difficult to really get a grip on that. And that's where I want to turn to sort of the big thing. What's in front of you right now? You have a statute. That's the direction from the legislature. They told the PUC, don't permit threats of serious injury. We have here undisputed facts of a 34% increase in carbon dioxide emissions from this state alone going upward. And that's going to be around for 50 years. it's going to warm the earth for 100 years past every year that that carbon dioxide is emitted. I would agree with Mr. Smith. Global warming is in probably one of the most grave, serious environmental injuries that we're going to have to cope with. This is difficult, and generations to come are going to have to cope with it. This 34% increase is coming at a time when South Dakota and all the rest of us are going to have to be making sharp, immediate reductions in order for all of us to have our fair share of tackling this problem. 15 to 20% is what we're hearing by 2020, well within the lifetime of this plant, well within the next 20 years. That's opposite directions. That's what we anticipate the legislature was thinking of when they passed this far-reaching statute. I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the issues with respect to the other pollutants. No doubt, Big Stone 2 is an improvement for many air pollutants. That's not contested. It's not before you. There were findings in that regard. But this statute does not say allow a threat of serious injury if they're doing a good job elsewhere. Give them a pass on some serious injury that might be a hard question if they're doing a good job of reducing pollutants elsewhere. There is a submission that South Dakota cannot alone solve global warming. Of course not. None of us can solve global warming alone. But we all have a piece, and that's where statutes like this or statutes like the Clean Air Act come in. In fact, we regulate many things that an individual state or an individual facility is not the cause of or is not going to be able to solve on their own. Sulfur dioxide emissions, which this plant is making progress on, cause acid rain, contribute to acid rain. That's not something that this plant or this state can solve on its own, but this state recognizes the importance of participating in that. And I think that's really where this statute goes. Briefly, Mr. Welk discussed the need, which is, of course, not really before you here. Of course, power is needed. Again, that did not come before you on appeal. And there were some questions from Justice Meyer Henry to both myself and to Mr. Welk about, well, how do we meet that need? Are there other ways to meet that need that are less polluting? There is evidence of other ways to meet that need, but even more importantly, there was a discussion in the record about offsets, about trading, that would allow even coal to be used, but that we have to think about that 34% increase and the need for attendant reductions. And there are many states, there are many business entities that were discussing this in the record, where might Congress go on a trading or an offsetting kind of thing? There are other ways that we can meet the need of the citizens of the state and the region with respect to their power. There's been some discussion. I'd like to respond to what exactly is the PUC's job here. What is the scope of their obligations? Are they to be sort of this roving environmental police, if you will, with respect to such a difficult and large problem as global warming? We're not asking for that, and I don't think that this court has to address that kind of question. What's really happening here is application of a statute. This is not something that is tenuous. It's real. It's a real injury to the environment. There are going to be real contributions to it. The PUC does have an obligation to weigh threats to the environment. It has a lot of other obligations as well, as Mr. Welk points out. There's a broad scope, there's a big record, but this court has never held, and in fact has held the opposite, that you can meet some of your obligations as an agency, but not others. If there is direction from the legislature, or if the agency has their own rules, they are required to abide by those and work within that direction and within those rules. And right now, the siting statute is the direction that we have from the South Dakota legislature. And that really is what's before the court today. And we believe that the evidence rises to that level of inquiry. And so I think that the property is...
Let me ask you about the evidence. What evidence rises to that level? In other words, let's assume that the 34%, well, the 34% is accurate. Nobody disputes it. What evidence is there on the record of a quantifiable increase risk and harm resulting from that 34%?
The evidence in the record on that in that regard comes primarily from Dr. Hausman's testimony.
But a quantifiable increased risk and harm.
Doctor, at no time did any of the parties here say, well, global warming will increase across the globe X percent due to Big Stone. That was not said. Indeed, cannot be said. I don't think the statute dictates that level of detail. But the unequivocal testimony from Dr. Hausman was that this plant, and he was very clear on that because he knew he was responding to some of the criticisms, this plant will contribute to and exacerbate the global warming problems that we are currently experiencing both worldwide, but also, he said, regionally and within the state, and he said he is certain of that. He also spoke very specifically to Mr. Uggerud's arithmetic calculation, where it, again, Mr. Uggerud said, it comes out to have some zeros in front of a 7, and that doesn't seem like very much. That's a tiny number when most people look at it at a number of that size. Dr. Hausman, very specifically on the basis of all of his knowledge, said, no, it may have a lot of zeros, but that's a big number. As Mr. Smith told you, we are talking about a lot of sources of carbon dioxide, some as small as a single automobile. The mere fact, according to Dr. Hausman, that you can even put a number to this emission, that you can understand what percentage. I mean, the entirety of the United States, I think the record says, is 8% of worldwide emissions in terms of power plants. So even that is not what we would normally consider a large number. But he specifically said the arithmetic here demonstrates this is a large source. It will contribute, and it will be a problem, and it will be part of the problem that is felt locally and nationally. If there are no further questions, I'll conclude my argument.
Thank you. Court will be in recess.